Welcome to NAOP San Francisco Bay Area's podcast, where we engage, deliberate, and highlight the commercial real estate market and its leaders. Our goal is to reach our listeners and our community through dynamic engagements both in and around commercial real estate. We explore how the industry works firsthand from all facets. Our intention is to keep our listeners up to date with what's happening in the market, conversations with senior leaders, political issues impacting the industry, and more.
Welcome everyone to another NAOP San Francisco Bay Area podcast. I'm your host, Dave Carroll with Ridge Capital Investors. I'm very pleased to be joined here today with an old friend, James Goddard, partner at Wareham Development, a prolific developer of life science and other comparable categories in the Bay Area. James, thank you for joining us.
Why, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I'd love to tell more about you and Wareham, but why don't I hand it off to you and let you give an intro. Tell us a little bit about the company and about yourself, when Wareham started, how long you've been there. Just give us a little bit of background for our listeners.
Sounds perfect. Wareham was formed in 1977, and we've been 100% Bay Area focused biotech player mostly. I've been with Wareham for 23 years. I handle capital markets, so acquisitions, dispositions, debt and equity, and portfolio management.
Awesome. And just to give us a sense of scale, how big is Wareham in terms of people or number of buildings or square footage, however you want to characterize that?
Yeah, so people-wise, we're 100% vertically integrated. So we have our own in-house property management, accounting, and effectively facility engineers. So we're about 75 people firm-wide. Space-wise, we're about 3 million square feet.
Okay, great. And could you fill us a little bit more, expand on the life science development piece and sort of what exactly is it that Wareham tries to build? What do you guys look to do in the Bay Area? Tell us a little bit about like your project focus.
Yeah, so the life science has been our core play actually almost from inception. And the idea is that we want to be in high barrier to market, high barrier to entry markets. And that can actually be from an entitlement standpoint and also from like a lot standpoint. So if there's an area where there's a lot of large kind of scalable lots that's easy to entitle, we don't want to play in that area. So we like to be in the markets where it's more difficult to get entitlements and you have to do like an assemblage play. So thus we've kind of focused on Berkeley, Emeryville, and Palo Alto for major life science campuses.
And I always thought of Wareham as being sort of the dominant player in Emeryville and Berkeley. Is that fair to say as sort of where you guys got started and had the biggest concentration?
Yeah, I'd say that's fair. We started off there. We're probably at this point in time about 80% of the Berkeley Emeryville biotech market.
Oh, wow. Okay. And so most of the development there, it's been a build and hold strategy. So you sort of just accumulated and added to that over time.
That's exactly the play. Yeah. So I've been with Wareham 23 years, and in 23 years, I've sold 4 projects. So if that tells you how often we sell, it's people say I wear a lot of hats. The disposition hat is not worn very often, about once every 5 years.
So stepping back and taking a little bit more of a historical perspective, since Wareham has been around for a while, since 1977, and I consider you one of the older established developers in the Bay Area, it feels like life science has become sort of a darling asset class in the last few years since COVID. Can you tell us a little bit about how things have changed for you since Wareham began or since you started there?
Okay, so when I started 23 years ago, I'd say that, first off, I had hair. So that's the most important thing. The second thing is that I don't have to explain what life science is to people anymore. When I first started off, it was kind of an asset class that wasn't the most kind of well-known and the like. So this was actually a situation where I had to explain and do a lot of base work to get people to the table. From a tenant standpoint, the biggest difference is back in the day, people would raise $5-7.5 million on the tenant side, their A and B rounds. Now they're raising substantially more. Now it's 50, kind of the modern structure is more of a $50-100 million kind of A or B round. So the capital stacking on the tenant side is completely different. It's much more robust. On the real estate side, it's definitely much easier, especially the last couple of years, to raise kind of debt and equity for biotech deals, especially going vertical. That dynamic has definitely been impacted by COVID. If you kind of look at kind of funding into kind of biotechs in 2018, 2019, pre-pandemic, that was about $25 billion a year for VC funding. That kind of roughly went up 80% increase for kind of like the couple big COVID years. As we sit here in 2023, we're probably back down to that $20-25 billion funding level. So we're back to kind of where we were pre-COVID. But what that big rush in for about 2.5 years has done is it created a lot of new entrants in the marketplace, on the real estate side.
Interesting. On the tenant side, in terms of the tenants getting larger initial rounds and more VC funding going into life science and biotech companies, has that affected the sort of real estate you develop or the tenants you work with, the demand you're dealing with? Has it had a change on your business?
Not for us, not a massive change. I'd say that tenant fundraising was pretty substantial pre-COVID anyhow on the sizing. So it's just so I don't think there's been a massive change, kind of like in tenants being different or the amount of capital they're raising. I mean, they're definitely raising more, but it wasn't completely outsized or completely different from kind of what it was just before COVID.
Gotcha. And what about on the real estate side? As you said, a lot more players. It feels like some of those are the new operators and developers who suddenly discovered that they're life science experts. And some of this is new capital sources that are flowing to those players and existing players. How has that affected you?
So there's definitely, I mean, there's new product coming online now. I mean, you're seeing this in the three major markets, Boston, San Francisco, and San Diego. So, I mean, Boston's probably the most heavily hit with this. San Francisco, we're probably number two out of these markets getting hit with new supply. The new supply seems to be mostly concentrated down the kind of South San Francisco Peninsula marketplace. We do have some of it in the East Bay, but not to the same level. Again, there's not as many kind of large plots of land that are easily entitlable in the East Bay versus what's happening in the peninsula or South San Francisco. So there's kind of a bit of a natural guardrail in the East Bay compared to some of the other submarkets.
Yeah. I know Ware might be more of a, I want to say, thoughtful developer, taking your time and finding sort of the right acquisitions, the right opportunities. So are you seeing much more competition for those opportunities from the comparable developers and competitors, or is it they're doing a different game, different animal?
Yes, that's a good question. So our focus is kind of the campus model. And we think that kind of coming in, having a large campus where we actually have scalability, so we can actually put into these campuses kind of the amenitized package, and we can expand and contract tenants. We think that is actually a competitive advantage. Other people have realized this as well when it comes to biotech. But we actually kind of focus on our main campus locations, so it's Berkeley, Emeryville, and Palo Alto. So those are kind of, and also Point Richmond. So, but those markets, we kind of focus kind of right around our campuses. So we're not out battling with everybody else, kind of just doing a one-off type project, which is what a lot of other people were doing. We're more kind of campus focused. So I'd say that we're probably not necessarily fighting with everybody else for the same deal. We're more focused on projects kind of in our hubs.
Gotcha. And what does the campus environment allow you to do with the tenants or with the project?
Well, so if like a tenant comes to us, actually, and this cuts both ways, we can have a tenant that's at 30,000 square feet and they need to shrink to 15,000 square feet. Then we have another tenant who's at 30,000 square feet and they need to expand to 45. Well, so sometimes you think, oh my God, we have a problem here. A tenant needs to contract by 15,000 square feet. We can put that together, and lo and behold, it's a win-win for everybody. The tenant who needs to give up space is in a better situation, and we satisfied, which is what our job is. At the end of the day, we all work for tenants. None of us would have a paycheck if it wasn't for the tenants. So we need to satisfy and keep them happy. So kind of they go from the 30,000 to 45,000 square feet to continue the business growth.
Yep, makes sense. A lot of synergies there.
Right. And we also have things where we have 24-hour kind of facility engineering, campus-wide security, gym facilities, restaurants on site. We have all that kind of capacity that you can handle when you have the scale. If you just have one building for 200,000 square feet off by itself, you can't do all that. And we also like to be in markets where, let's say, the location is part of the amenitization package. So if an infill location like in Emeryville or Berkeley, we have proper like transportation that comes to those markets, right, into our campuses. You also have restaurants that are right off campus. So if you don't want to eat on campus, so to quote unquote, you can eat off campus.
Right.
So the kind of location is like an added level of amenities.
Right. And so in terms of how you guys look at those developments, other elements that you would say are important for the sort of developments you do, something unique, I mean, to life science, like something you guys think about in terms of an advantage or challenge in how you build these projects.
You're talking about like a new ground up type project or like a rehab?
Either, actually. I don't know. Have you guys done much rehab, like office to life science conversion?
Actually, we have. We started off more doing, back in the day, we started off doing more of the conversion type play. And as time has gone on, we've gone to more of the ground up. But we still obviously do both. So if it's in a, if it's, I think that the conversion play works well if it's in great location. If it's in a situation where you have, it also is nice to have the conversion play in a campus because you, then you kind of have a differentiated product type. So if you take a warehouse that you convert, and let's say you have a tenant that wants to do a scale up facility, right? So they're doing research inside their lab space and they go, okay, this research works, but we need to know if it works in scale before we build a production plant. They need, sometimes they need like a bigger facility that has higher floor to ceiling heights so they can actually kind of scale it up. That aspect is very valuable to have right on campus. So we do things like that. We can actually do a larger fermentation facility. So not having just 100% all the same product creates a value in a campus environment as well.
That's interesting. Hey, what about from a deal structure standpoint? Anything unique in terms of how you would either redevelop or develop a life science deal and how you'd structure that with your financial partner or internally?
Yeah, so you need to have more capital into a life science deal up front than you do like a traditional office or other product type, because that first generation, that build out is so expensive. That's the bit of the kind of the secret sauce for lab deals is that once you incur that first cost structure, additional kind of turn costs are very limited. It's much more akin to like a cross-dock warehouse, TI-wise. It's more function-based. So it's not like other product types like office or retail, where it's basically aesthetic-based. So that aspect, so that the office or the retail, that's an expensive turn when you have a tenant turnover. Lab is kind of the opposite. It's much more kind of akin to a warehouse, where it's very limited. So you have a large upfront cost structure, but after you've built it and it's stabilized, it is much more stable and you actually have more of your kind of NOI drop to your bottom line cash flow and not get gobbled up by CapEx.
So let's touch on that for a second, because I've always been curious in this. So understand the improvements are reusable for future tenants. Is there a useful life to that? So when we talk about the specialized HVAC or other improvements you're doing for life science space, do you assume that's going to last you for 10, 20, 30 years? Can you just keep recycling tenants, or does the technology change and you have to swap those out?
So that's a really good question. So it's the reason why the first generation build out for lab space is so expensive is because you have to put so much infrastructure in. So the biggest difference kind of stepping back between like an office project and a lab is that an office project, you recirculate the air three or four times. So the air comes in, gets conditioned, gets recirculated through the space three or four times, then gets exhausted out. In a lab deal, it's completely different. The air comes in, gets conditioned to the right temperature, and then gets exhausted out immediately. So it's a single pass. So you need to have about three times more capacity on the roof, which needs, you need to have a stronger roof structure, you need to have more gas, nor more electrical. So it's all that infrastructure. You need to have wider shafts to get the volume of air in and out. You need to have higher floor to ceiling heights so you can actually run the ducts. So it's all that kind of stuff that once it gets in, you don't have to replicate. So the stuff that you kind of see, like the benches, if people want to take the bench out and they want to, instead of having a bench type layout for the lab, they want to actually, you can actually now have it where you have kind of all the infrastructure hanging from the ceiling. All the infrastructure is already there. So you're just having a delivery kind of difference inside the suite. That doesn't cost the money. It's having all the infrastructure to the suite that costs the money.
Right, right.
And that's reusable, obviously.
So it'd be fair to say we're talking really more about base building capital than we're talking about actual finishes and tenant spaces.
Exactly. That's the best way of putting it.
Okay. And so as you think then going forward and how you're seeing the landscape right now, and again, pardon my ignorance on the subject topic, but I hear about things like fake meat proteins being made in quote unquote life science space. Could you tell me and the listeners a little bit more about how you categorize these buckets of technology that fall under life science?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it fake meat.
that's real meat, I guess.
Right. So it's synthetic meat, it's truly meat. It's just not off an animal. It's actually grown in a lab. So back in the day, kind of like decades ago, the major demand driver for tenants in the biotech space was the classic medical kind of pharma type play. And you look around and you see what's kind of going on in the marketplace now, and you have different word legs on the demand stool. And you have like, it's called food 2.0. And that's where it's basically synthetic protein. And people are doing things where they're trying to do salmon, they're trying to do chicken. You also have synthetic biology, which is trying to basically solve and create a product that we need, but by not destroying the environment. So it's an environmental way of trying to produce what we need. You also have kind of like cell therapy, kind of like personalized medicine. You have all these things that are slightly different. They all use the same space from a real estate standpoint, but they're different demand drivers. And I'd say from a diversification standpoint, the East Bay probably has the most diverse kind of demand stool, so to speak, with these groups. But this is definitely spreading, and other markets are getting kind of these diversification plays with the tenant demand as well.
So, James, touching on those various user types, how does that look in Emeryville and Berkeley in particular? Is there something unique going on there versus some of the other markets?
Yeah, so I'd say that in general, markets seem to have slightly different kind of like tenant sizes and profiles. Like the South San Francisco, Mission Bay kind of market seems to have more kind of larger companies. It'd be more focused on those kind of groups. The East Bay, I would say, has a different stratification. So there's multiple kind of third-party incubator facilities, and they kick out, 2,000 and 5,000 square foot tenants that are kind of the incubator type growth. And those become like 5 and 10,000 square foot groups that then pop and become the 50s. So, and the East Bay, we have plenty of large tenants as well. So I'd say there's a larger stratification in the East Bay than the other markets with regards to tenant size. So there seems to be more kind of like a larger percentage of 2 to 10,000 square foot tenants. And also some of the kind of like the 20 to 30s as well, versus some of like the South San Francisco, which is a very large tenant marketplace, and kind of the peninsula as well.
If you are getting more startup or early stage companies, does it lead to shorter terms, lesser credit, more turnover? Does it have a different profile then, how the asset actually functions?
Yeah, so that's very interesting. I'd say that we definitely get less credit, which is par for the course, but the credit risk isn't really the issue because the space is so reusable. So that's not the end of the world. You probably get slightly less term because by design, they don't want to be there. They don't want to sign a 10-year lease when they're 5,000 square feet.
Right.
Because one way or another, they're not going to be there in 10 years. Either it's a positive story or a negative story. Most of the time, it's a positive story, but they want to have some flexibility. So this is the classic real estate versus how do you work with the tenant type aspect? The real estate person wants to have as long a lease as possible. And the tenant wants to have as much flexibility as possible.
Right.
So there's a bit more flexibility, though, I'd say, in the smaller suites, just because that's the nature of the dance.
Mm. But would it be fair to say that since you are in a market that has more robust demand, especially from the startup side or smaller format side, that it's not as sensitive to tenant rollover, tenant turn?
Yes, that's probably true.
It's interesting. So is there some part of you guys that start patting yourself on the back and being like, hey, we got into this space 50 years ago and figured it out, and now the demand
day,
pool for
absolutely.
Us is just increasing all around us.
We knew this was going to happen.
Couldn't have underrated better,
right? No, so I've been around Wareham for half of its existence. So I know, going way back, did we see all this going to happen? Or did I even see this 23 years ago? No. Sometimes if you set yourself up, though, in kind of like in an environment where you have high barriers to entry, you're in a product type that's not a commodity product type, you kind of have a campus environment and an infill location, you do set yourself up. It takes a long time. It's not very exciting, especially doing kind of assemblage plays where you buy a quarter of a block and a quarter of a block at a time. It takes decades, but you do end up with like a competitive advantage and kind of having a fortress-like kind of a business model. That definitely helps. But this level of tenant demand has been robust.
Right. And to the extent you can share details there, when you said the business model, you mentioned, I think, four sales you were saying during your career?
Right.
Could you expand on that? Because we don't see that much build-to-own development. You see a lot of developers, it tends to be more of a build and flip model. You build and then you sell and you get your immediate upside as soon as possible.
Right.
Tell us a little bit more about why build and why hold.
Yeah. So you'll see the develop, lease, flip type play. Right. So the develop, lease, flip play, that works well like an office. You see that most of the kind of more of the common product types, the commodity product types. You don't see that in the lab. Usually lab people seem to hold on to stuff for a bit longer and the like. So the lab has less of that kind of develop and flip type component. A lot of it's because it's a growing industry and you want to grow with your tenants and satisfy their needs. So if you're constantly selling out from underneath them, that doesn't help kind of your long-term growth plan if you're in kind of like in a campus environment in particular. So I'd say there's that aspect. We structure our deals. Each building is in a separate LLC, so each one has its own capital stack. But we make sure that we always have long-term capital in there because there's no point in trying to set yourself up for long-term, expand the campus, do all this, but you either have short-term debt or short-term equity in the capital stack, where there, I mean, that has to come out before you want to exit the project.
Right.
So for us, we're not an IRR-based investment group. We're effectively kind of like a good old-fashioned cash-on-cash investment group. So for us, the hold is infinite. With regards to individual projects that are kind of ground-up development deals, let's say we use 60% loan to cost and 40% is equity. So that has not really changed much. And then when we finance out after stabilization, we usually kind of, that goes to like a 45% loan to cost. So, and gotcha. we don't add on to that. So we kind of like finance out the construction loans at par.
Gotcha. So lower leverage holds plays with yield, which makes
sense. Extreme low leverage. People laugh at our leverage levels. It's fabulous.
No, I mean, it creates stability and safety through cycles, right?
Right. One of the kind of the thesis of the company is that extremely low leverage is a massive asset, because at least in Bay Area real estate, it's difficult to lose money long term. And the way you do is if you get cashed out at a trough, right? So if you don't get cashed out of the trough and you're kind of in a high demand product type, holding on and just being there the long term is going to be is an asset creation by itself.
Right. It's interesting to understand that. So as the mostly office commercial person over here who's feeling a lot of envy right now, could you at least tell us some story of challenge or resilience, some tough time in life science market as a whole or for you in particular?
I'll use the story, but I'm not sure if the ending is very positive.
Okay. More ways to make you sound good.
Right,
I like
exactly.
It. Okay.
Just to rub it in. So I'd say about 15 years ago, had a project where I was in the middle of kind of redoing the debt and the equity. And we had an 18,000 square foot tenant who had financial problems, kind of right on schedule, right? Because these things always happen when you least need them. The debt and equity got concerned. And I said, don't worry, very shortly, we'll actually have the space released. So within 3 weeks, we had three tenants inside the building who wanted the 18,000 square feet. We cut it up into three separate 6,000 square foot suites, and we actually leased it for equal or greater than what the previous tenant was paying. Debt and equity obviously was very happy with that, and that kind of was the kind of seminal moment for them. And they realized this was a product type. I mean, this is 15 years ago. They realized there was a robustness to this product type, because big picture, biotech is definitely, I mean, while it has outsized returns, it does not come with an outsized risk curve that goes with it. I'd say it's probably a lower beta than pretty much anything out there, because it's a demographic investment. So it doesn't float with the overall economy or the S&P 500.
Gotcha. And just to clarify that for any listeners out there, when you say demographic investment, could you expand on that?
Yeah, so if you get nerdy and you look at demographic curves, every year in the United States, the average age is getting longer.
Thank you, boomers.
Right? Yes, exactly, right? And we're all getting older. So we're having less kids and the like. What that results in is that as we kind of increase this demographic curve, and this is happening worldwide, it's not just the United States, it's happening in Japan, it's happening in Italy, it's happening in the westernized world, is that we need kind of more medicines to help people out as they get older. And we also need like more medical office space, more assisted living. So that's kind of like the demographic investment kind of thesis. And a lot of people are kind of been focused on that for decades. We think that's very important as well. And what that does is if you're linked with a demographic investment, that you can have something where the S&P 500 or the overall economy goes down for a bit, but it doesn't have a dramatic impact on what you're doing kind of on a long-term basis.
Yeah. I mean, it seems as long as you have low leverage and you can hold long-term, it feels like the market's moving your way.
Right. The tide's definitely floating the boats. As time buys you, as time goes on, you will actually be better off.
Yep. Makes sense. So I'm going to tee you up one more time to pat you on the back yet again.
Okay.
So
keep going. All day.
As we talked about some of these challenges in your long established career doing life science development, do you want to share just like another big accomplishment or story from your past, or sort of something you'd be the most proud of that you want to pass on to some younger folks in the industry?
I'm not sure if it's the most proud, but I mean, we did have some, so it's nice to have dry powder and kind of have a low leverage structure that we talked about earlier. So when the great recession occurred in 2008, 2009, we were desirous as a firm to be down in the Palo Alto market. And we've been looking for years, and it's a tough market to get into. Costs are high. There's not a lot of deal velocity or volume down there. And there's a project that came up in the Stanford Research Park that was a biotech deal. And start looking into it. And it's course, it's on a ground lease, so it's massively complicated. It's on a ground lease, had a first mortgage that could no longer be assumed because they used up all the transfer options, and had a mezz piece on top of it that made one of those zero cash flow deals. I'm not sure if you remember those, where they scrape all the cash flow, so there's literally zero cash flow left in the deal.
Yep.
So, I mean, those were popular for a short window of time. So that's how the deal was set up. The borrower or the owner of the project was having some financial problems. It was a great project, though. So the real estate was great. So I start getting involved in that transaction, and I find out that the lender happens to be a group that I'm very close with, have a great relationship with. So I call them up, and they go, James, we'd love to transfer the loan to you, even though there aren't any transfer options left. So I'm like, that's fabulous. Then I have to restructure the mezz piece. And all this stuff had to be restructured and assumed because, as you know, in 2009, there wasn't a lot of new capital floating around,
right,
especially on the
right.
debt side. Right. So after going through all this, we were able to close that. And I think it was in the middle of 2009. So that was kind of how we first got into the Palo Alto market.
No, interesting. Given the long history in Emeryville, Berkeley, I didn't realize that was the first time Palo Alto.
Right.
Yeah. Maybe more Cal Bear fans than Stanford fans, but we'll read into that.
Right.
That's great. So is that project now fully leased?
Yeah. So when we bought it, it was fully leased. It's remained fully leased the entire way through. So it's located in the Stanford Research Park. It is 3373-3375 Hillview. So right on the cross is Foothill right there. So it's a great location and it's definitely a long-term hold for us.
That's great. So I appreciate that perspective going back to global financial crisis and sort of the multi-cycle development that you've gone through. So, you know, we always like to end these things with some advice for our younger listeners. Any advice you'd like to impart on the younger members of NAOP for their career or life science or otherwise?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's important that you work with people you like, respect, and that are smart. You want to be the dumbest person in the room so you can basically learn from everybody else. The other aspect, this is easier said than done, you want to be at a firm or in a position within the firm where what you do makes a difference in the overall successful outcome of the project. And you're not just relying on the marketplace to have the S&P 500 double and that be your business plan type aspect. You want to have it where what you do matters and makes an impact that can help the overall returns of the project, and you're just not completely dependent on what's going on in the marketplace.
I love that. I love not being afraid to quote unquote be the dumbest person in the room. Like, that's always a good attitude. I feel that quite often myself.
Well, that's my goal, so I'm usually successful.
Well, James, I really appreciate you joining us today.
This is absolutely fabulous. Always a pleasure seeing you, and thank you very much as well for your time and for the invitation.
You as well. Thank you for joining us. And listeners, thank you again for another wonderful NAOP San Francisco Bay Area podcast.
Hey, listeners. Thank you for joining our conversation and being part of NAOP San Francisco Bay Area Chapter's podcast community. Our goal is to reach our listeners through dynamic engagements, both in and around all things commercial real estate. So if you like what you hear, please like, subscribe, and share our podcast with your personal and professional networks. We love feedback and would appreciate a review on whichever platform you prefer. And if you're interested in becoming a NAOP member, you can find out more at naopsfba.org. That's naopsfba.org. Or follow us on LinkedIn, Twitter, and Instagram. Until next time, take care, and we hope you join us again.